Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of April 22nd, 2011. 5 years ago, the housing market peaked, and it has been downhill from there. But how far downhill?
In terms of timing the actual bottom, the market bottom has proven more elusive than I think most people expected.
We'll revisit one city that seemed for a while to avoid the housing bust. Jobs are still scarce, so lots of people are trying their hand at starting a new business, and that often means going without health insurance.
During the time when I was very sick, it really did make me think I wish I'd stayed in teaching because I would have health coverage.
Did healthcare reform change that equation? We will find out. And why does your zip code have anything to do with what you're paying for car insurance? Why?
If there are a lot of people crashing frequently where you live, then that does affect your own premium.
We've got tips on how to save on auto coverage. Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/marketplacemoney.
Hard to believe, but we are now 5 years removed from the peak of the housing bubble, April 06. The most recent monthly snapshots say prices are still falling, which may be one reason home sales are up. Applications for mortgages are up, too. 1 year ago this week, we broadcast an entire show about housing from Seattle, where the bust hadn't really hit yet. One of the people we talked to was Stan Humphries, the chief economist for Zillow, and at the time, he offered this prediction for the future of the real estate market.
I tend to think that from where we are right now, we're going to see bottom in home prices nationally sometime before the middle part of this year, so by June. After we hit bottom, we're going to see 3, possibly 5 years of very flat housing performance in the U.S.
And Stan Humphries joins us again to talk about the year that was. Welcome back.
Glad to be back.
So what do you think about your statement from last year?
Boy, was I wrong there. Well, only wrong on part of it. Wrong on when we would bottom. I still hold to what's going to happen in the aftermath of the bottom, that it is going to be a very long period of time before we get back to normal appreciation rates. But in terms of timing the actual bottom, the market bottom has proven more elusive than I think most people expected.
You know, one of the things that you talked a lot about with us was the fact that, you know, at the time, about a year ago, Seattle was still not seeing a real terrible crunch in its housing market. But you predicted that it was going to be, a lagging indicator. And that's happened, hasn't it?
Yes. Unfortunately, it has. That Seattle, because it went into its housing recession about a year after the rest of the country, last year we expected it to get worse, and in fact it has. Home values were down about 24% from peak when we talked last year, and now they're down about almost 33% from peak. And in fact, I remember when we walked around Capitol Hill, we were talking about how few foreclosures there were.
Right.
And in Capitol Hill neighborhood of Seattle, you're still seeing less foreclosures than you are metro-wide, but the rates of foreclosures Seattle Metro have picked up a fair bit over the past year as well.
Are there other cities like Seattle that came to the housing bust late that you're seeing it happening now?
Yeah, in general, the Northwest markets are prototypical examples of ones that came into the housing recession late. So that's Seattle, Portland, Spokane. Some of the Dallas markets came in a little bit later, but not as late as the Northwest markets.
Then does the fact that the housing bust seems to have now hit all over the country, does that signal to us that perhaps we are out of the worst of it? I guess, given what happened in the last year, it's not safe to ask for a prediction, huh?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, what really, I think, worked against us in terms of forecasting and still makes forecasting very hard of these two key indicators that all economists look at have been pretty corrupted by external events, home sales and, on the other hand, foreclosure transactions. Hmm. Of course, home sales have been biased because of the Federal Home Buyer Tax Credit, which was in effect for most of 2009 and half of 2010. And then the time series on foreclosures has been disrupted because of various moratoriums that existed in 2009. And then, of course, the robo-signing controversies in the fall of 2010 also led to slowdowns in foreclosures. And those time series are very important for predicting what's going to happen in the future.
Well, I know you live in Seattle, but can you give us any sunlight? Any good news happening in the housing market at all?
Well, I think that, you know, on the one hand, we've certainly seen a reduction in demand in home sales after the tax credits came off. But I guess I've been somewhat optimistic about what we're seeing there, which is that at last we are getting a good look at underlying demand. And certainly that demand dropped off. We have seen very high depreciation rates nationally. But in February, we started to see a reduction in that depreciation rate. So homes are still falling, but they're falling at a lower, you know, a lower rate. I tend to think that now that the policy supports are out of the market, the fundamentals already have reasserted themselves. And I think that that means that, you know, a market bottom will be in the offing. Now, I hesitate to, you know, given my miss last time I spoke with you, yeah. You know, right now our forecasts do call for a bottom later this year nationally or early part of next year. So that's late 2011 or early 2012. But they do still call for a considerable time after the bottom, at least 3 years in most markets, where you're not going to see much appreciation even after you've hit bottom.
All right. Stan Humphries is the chief economist for Zillow. Stan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jess.
Nearly a decade ago, my husband and I learned that the old Manhattan row house we called home was in a state of gradual but accelerating collapse.
Commentator Catherine Greider.
We bolted with our two small children. Over the next year and a half, we anguished over whether to sell or try to repair the property. And I opened my eyes to something that should have been obvious all along. Holding the deed to our apartment didn't give us the power to choose. Our ownership rights were sharply limited by a crowd of fellow stakeholders, from the building's co-owners to bank representatives to city buildings officials. When we first bought the place, I'd held an appealing, soft-focused notion of homeownership as a gateway to independence, safety, and freedom. I was 30, pregnant with our first child. We were fashioning walls and storage bins as boundaries designating us and ours. And I suppose I was steeped in the cultural remnants of a centuries-old legal tradition that tied voting rights to land ownership. The small landowners, as Jefferson wrote, are the most precious part of a state. This glowing portrait of homeownership has a dark side, and that's the persistent denigration in American life of people who live in rentals and apartment buildings. We prefer to shield our eyes from the massive communal investment via government and financial institutions that underpins private homeownership. But we got a bracing display of this reality not long ago when the housing market tumbled into a ditch, taking with it big banks, great swaths of investors, and whole neighborhoods.
Catherine Greider is author of the new book, The Archaeology of Home. Post your comments on our Facebook page or send them to us at marketplace.org/money. Under the Obama health care reform plan, it's supposed to get easier to find affordable insurance if you leave a job to try your hand at being an entrepreneur. That's the theory, anyway. We sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman from the Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting to find out if health care reform is unleashing a small business wave.
I figured I'd start looking for a health care effect right at the beginning of the entrepreneurial pipeline.
My name is Jamie Kurt, and I'm the founder of Raintown Footwear. We design sophisticated urban rain boots made from recycled tires, much like the
students at the University of Portland's Center for Entrepreneurship are putting their business plans on the line in the annual elevator pitch competition.
Today I asked for $90,000 to move Raintown forward.
Many of these students say they're ready to launch right after college. One thing helping them along, under the new health care law, they can stay on their parents' health insurance until they're 26.
When I graduate, I don't think my company will pay benefits because they're a startup. So I probably wouldn't worry about health insurance until I was 26.
The insurance is a little bit cushy right now, so I plan on riding that out as long as I possibly can.
That's 21-year-old Sam Wegman, who's pitching. Well, here, I'll let him tell you.
Hello, my name is Sam, and I'm here to pitch a plan where I take my tunes to Denmark, Sweden, and the Netherlands.
It's something about digital distribution strategy for singer-songwriters like himself.
So to implement this plan, I'm looking for 12 grand.
He didn't win, by the way. First prize went to a DIY cupcake bakery, as in decorate it yourself. There are other healthcare changes coming that'll benefit the self-employed and people who want to jump jobs. Starting in 2014, state insurance exchanges will let individuals and small businesses join together to shop for coverage, and insurance companies won't be able to deny coverage or set sky-high rates based on age or pre-existing conditions.
The insurance market reforms and the health insurance exchanges, in some ways, will allow you to de-link health benefits from your job.
Economist Paul Fronston at the Employee Benefit Research Institute says the goal is to give everyone access to the kinds of plans big employers offer, and then let people keep their coverage.
And that'll give people an opportunity to take risks as far as opening up a business without having this fear about being denied health insurance coverage.
That fear leaves many mid-career professionals shackled to jobs they'd like to leave. Business consultant Gene Marks says insurance reform could give these people, with a Rolodex full of contacts and a cupboard full of cholesterol and blood pressure medications, a sort of get-out-of-my-9-to-5 job free card. Gene Marks says it can help companies looking for new blood, too.
You know, sometimes there are people that you'd like to hire or you'd like to work with, but you can't because they have a pre-existing condition, they can't leave their company, they can't change their health plans, it's very restrictive. Now with that new legislation, it does open up more opportunities for business owners to go out and grab people and some talent.
People who do go off on their own will be eligible for subsidies to buy insurance. Sarah Horowitz of the Freelancers Union says those subsidies phase out just under $90,000 a year in income. She says reform will increase access, but it won't necessarily hold down cost.
People that are, let's say, moderate income earners, kind of like your working middle class people, are still going to be having problems. With the increase in medical inflation, it's just going to cost more in the next few years.
Fledgling businesses now have access to subsidies to help them offer insurance to their employees. But it's still going to be a struggle for anyone founding a startup.
Well done, soy latte to get.
I call myself the director. You pretty much have to take on many, many different roles. Grocery shopping, going to the bank, putting the money in.
Kristen Hying helped turn this former meth house in Portland into a community center slash coffee bar called Café au Play.
We're getting ready for a work party tomorrow with pastries and coffee.
She believes in offering health insurance to her 3 employees, but says she can't afford it right now. She's on a government-subsidized plan herself. Hying's 41, raising a daughter, and at times she's gone without coverage. One of those times, she ended up with a trip to the emergency room and a $2,500 bill.
Especially during the time when I was very sick, it really did make me think I wish I'd stayed in teaching because I would have health coverage. But it would have been years of working on this, and, you know, I felt very strongly about finishing what I had started.
She just hopes healthcare reform will make finishing with insurance a little bit easier. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
Waiting on public transportation can be a real drag.
Because when the bus doesn't come, it's the worst. Which is partially why I don't take the bus, because it's too annoying. Because you wait and wait and wait.
We'll hear about a new app that promises to shorten your commute. That's coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. It is time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is Los Angeles Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. Hey, David.
Hello, Tess.
How have you been?
I've been good.
Well, I wanted to ask you real quickly about a column that you wrote about a week ago that really, I think, must have struck a nerve with a lot of your readers. You talked about magazine subscriptions, but these are no ordinary magazine subscriptions.
Bogus is the word that comes to mind here. Yeah, totally. You get these notices in the mail, and they look very official, and basically they say, send us a bunch of money because your subscription to XYZ magazine or newspaper is about up. Turns out these aren't from the publishers by and large. I wrote about a case of a guy who's got National Geographic for the past 30 years. He gets this notice in the mail. They want almost $60 for the renewal. Well, there's a few things wrong with this. First of all, National Geographic actually charges only $15 on its website. Moreover, you take a closer look at the thing, and it turns out it's not National Geographic at all. It's Publishers Billing Association in Reno, Nevada, a.k.a. Publishers Exchange, a.k.a. about a dozen other aliases.
Jeez.
And the Better Business Bureau says these guys have been notorious. And what they do is they send out these phony baloney sorts of renewal notices, and people, especially senior citizens, can easily get duped if they don't look closely at them.
Okay, so how do you know then if this is a fake fake or the real thing?
Well, typically there'll be some weasel words on the thing. So if you look really close, you'll see little tiny words that say this is not a bill or this is not actually from National Geographic or the Wall Street Journal or wherever. That's the first thing to look for here. But it got even sneakier because once I started digging into it, it turned out that on the back of the notice it said, and when you sign up, you'll join Orphans Waiting and be able to help the orphans of the world. Turns out that Orphans Waiting is actually a P.O. box in San Diego. And as best as I can tell, I can't find any sort of charitable activity on their part.
So it's a complete scam.
It's a double scam. You know, it just doesn't pass the smell test. So two things I would tell people. First of all, if you get these notices in the mail, ignore them because that's not the way you subscribe to publications. And second, if you want to help the orphans of the world and you want to give to charity, go to GuideStar. That's a website online that actually has legitimate charities on it. And you can feel a lot more confident that your money is going to do something.
Okay, that's GuideStar.org. And we'll have a link to that on our website. All right, well, let's hit the phones. And Brandy is with us from Denver, Colorado. Hi, Brandy.
Hi.
How you doing there?
Good. How are you?
Very well. Very well. What do you do there?
I am unemployed right now. I just moved back to Denver, my home city, where I haven't been here in 4.5 years. I just got here on Tuesday.
Oh, wow. So what have you been doing the last 4.5 years?
Living in Alabama on an inherited old family farm.
Wow. Was it a working farm?
No, it had been abandoned for 20 years, and it was covered in various invasive species, which we were really struggling to cut back. And in order to even turn it into a farm, we had to take care of those.
So this doesn't sound like Field of Dreams.
No.
This isn't Shoeless Joe Jackson.
It's like Jungle of Nightmares.
Well, so now you're living in Colorado. What did you do with the farm?
I sold it.
You sold it?
Yeah, it was a really, really big, huge decision I had to make. I didn't want to do it, but after being down there for so long.
Well, so you must have gotten something out of the deal.
I did. I have quite a bit of money, but I'm going to go to graduate school in England, and it's going to be around $40,000.
Are you going to tell us how much money you got?
Yeah, I got $180,000.
Okay. So we're looking at about 25% or so of the money that you got, a little less.
Yeah, and I'm concerned that grad school is just going to eat it all up, and I don't know what to do with the rest of it while I'm in school.
Well, so you're going to have, what, $140,000, $150,000 or so that you want to know what to do with? Is that the crux of it here?
Yeah, I looked into CDs.
Let me ask you this. What kind of investing history do you have? How much do you know about it?
I know absolutely nothing about it.
What you want to be doing, Brandy, is, first of all, focus on the near term. The near term is getting your degree, getting a gig, and you know, building your life. You're still young. You got to do all that. I would say, in the meantime, you want to park your money somewhere safe and short-term while you get your bearings. Safe and short-term means certificate of deposit. It means
online savings account.
Online savings account, a mutual fund, money market fund. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to be too risky. You want to be plain vanilla for something like this, and you don't want to lock it into anything really, really long-term. So you don't want, say, a five-year CD. You want, you know, something shorter, maybe a one-year CD that you can renew when you want to. You're going to earn a decent interest. It's not going to, you know, get you a new farm, but at least your money will be working for you. In the meantime, do a little homework about how money works. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff out there. Jane Bryant Quinn, for example, has a terrific and very, very thick book that you can get into.
There's a reason it's called the Bible.
Yes.
Okay.
That will kind of walk you through everything. It's not the kind of thing you read in one sitting because it's bigger than the Lord of the Rings, but but it's in plain English and it's pretty straightforward. And you'll find that there's other such books like that.
Investing for Dummies is really, you know, it's got all the basics and, you know, it's solid information.
Yeah, it's real meat and potato stuff.
So, Brandy, does that give you some first steps?
It does. It does. And I really appreciate the help.
All right. Well, good luck to you. Thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Ginny and Beth. And, I believe they're calling from two different places. Hello, Ginny.
Hello.
And you're in Albany, correct?
Correct.
And Beth is in Vermont.
That's right.
So do we have what? Best friends, sisters, what?
All of the above. Best friends and sisters.
Oh, this is like a TV show. This is great.
Well, so we've got two sisters, and we're going to talk about a family matter.
Right.
All right.
Right.
Who are we going to talk about?
I'm just going to call her Grandma. It was February 11th. Grandma called me in a panic because she had bounced 6 checks at the bank.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and so...
So you're calling her Grandma, but this is your mother?
Yeah, this is our mother.
Okay.
Our children's grandma.
Right, okay. Right.
So this is February 11th of this year?
Yes, yes. She told me this, and so my husband and I went down to take her to dinner, and her bills were all out on the table. We discovered she had been using credit cards for all her expenses and just paying the minimum.
Oh,
that's a dangerous game.
And so her savings are almost depleted. There's just about maybe there's $2,000 in.
Oh, my goodness.
How much does she owe in total?
In total, yeah. About $39,000.
Oh.
Yeah.
And how old is she?
87.
Yow.
Oh,
yeah.
Man. Do you know how and why this happened?
I mean, I asked her several times. I don't see how she could not know how to use a credit card. I'm trying to get her to live within her means.
Well, she's getting Social Security, obviously.
Yep.
Does she have any sort of pension or anything?
She has an IRA that's prorated, and her payment this year was it $8,800, Bessie?
Yes, $8,800 was her required minimum distribution on it.
Okay. Right. She has less than $400 in her savings account, which is where she puts her minimum distribution. So she blew through that in like 3 months.
Oh, boy.
And she owns property also?
She owns her house.
It's the house we all grew up in.
Let me ask a really indelicate question that I'm sure everyone's wondering right now, and that is mom / grandma, is all the wiring, I mean, how do I phrase
it? Well, you know, I really thought that she was wired pretty good for someone her age.
Yeah, and I think, David, that most of the studies have shown that money management is one of the very first things
to go. A telltale sign.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's rather a comfort to hear this, because that lets me know what I have to do.
Well, and it could provide an explanation beyond just the frustration that you're seeing.
Right.
And more to the point, it's going to help address the plan of action, because
right.
You can't let this sit, obviously.
No, I can't. I think it's accelerating fast.
She's now paying interest on interest.
Oh, boy.
All right, let's pick this thing apart. You've got three goals, it sounds like to me. First of all, protect the house.
Yes.
You know, you got to protect the big asset.
Right.
Second of all, you've got to deal with $39,000 in debt.
Yes.
Third of all, mom has to learn how to live within her means. So you have a three-step thing that needs to be accomplished here, and they're all toughies.
Yep.
Yes.
So let's be clear on all that. So first of all, the house, let's set that aside, because that's just, we're going to kind of, let's make that a given, that no one's going to touch the house.
Right.
Unless it's a worst-case scenario. And let's face it, if mom's looking at assisted living or something like that, you know, the house is going to be what's going to pay for that. But get to that another time. The debt is the first thing,
first and foremost. $39,000.
Now, have you guys discussed getting a credit counselor involved?
Well, I did call a couple of them. We have one right here in Albany, and we did over the phone. We used her numbers, and her payment for all her credit cards, it wouldn't be much different than it is right now.
Right, but sometimes the function of getting credit counseling is that they can work with the credit issuers to get you, say, a lower interest rate. So that you're actually paying it off instead of just making a minimum payment that's going to just keep getting you behind.
So let's say your first step is you get a credit counselor and you at least survey the landscape and get a better sense of how to get your hands around the debt. So that's the first step you and your sisters need to do. So that's going to start addressing the debt side of this. Now, the other side of this is getting mom / grandma to live within her means. And you guys are going to have to do an intervention here. So you need to sit down with her and either bring her along to the credit counselor, bring her to the bank, walk her through the actual mechanics of her finances, or just sit down with her and educate her, because otherwise she is going to squander what's left.
All right. Does that help you guys out?
You bet.
I think so.
All right. Well, that is one tough situation, but I'm really glad that you guys came to us with this, because it's not uncommon.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much for the call, and let us know how it goes, would you? Would you call us back and let us know?
Oh, we will.
Sure will.
All right, and finally we go to Rachel, and she's in Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Tess.
What do you do there in Brooklyn?
I do post-production for cable networks. So,
what's the most recent thing you worked on?
Well, recently was cutting a re-airing of the Charlie's Angels series.
Yes! Yes! Now, when one cuts Charlie's Angels, what is one eliminating?
Well,
not Farrah.
No, of course not. No.
Okay, so what do you take? You can't hang out Charlie. What do you take out?
No, just little extras. Back in the 70s, the shows were a little longer than they are today. So it was like very long pans, lots of shots of people parking cars and things. So it was just little extras. You just cut a little bit here and there so the show gets to the current running time you need now.
So. In other words,
so you need more commercials.
Some more commercials.
More commercial time, that's right.
Wow. All right, so how can we help you out today? Because we don't know anything about television.
And I can't do the Charlie's Angels theme, so.
Okay. No, man. No.
Well, I have a question about a life insurance policy that my parents took out for me when I was 5 years old.
5 years old? Wait a minute.
Well, yeah. Wait, they know something you didn't?
They took out a life insurance policy on you?
Yes.
Why did they do that? Did they ever explain it to you?
Well, my parents said it was like for an investment. It's like a 65 life. That's what the policy's called.
Hmm.
Jeepers, I think a savings bond would have been a little more appropriate.
Yeah.
Right. So recently, they gave me the paperwork so I could sign the beneficiary over to my husband because they were previously the beneficiaries.
How old are you, may I ask?
I just turned 40 last month.
Okay. Do you know what this is worth?
From what it says is that currently the cash value is worth $3,800 and the total death benefit is $12,700.
After 35 years?
What do they pay like 50 cents a month? What do they pay?
Yes.
Well, I was looking at the paperwork. In the last year or two, the cash value has increased about $180 a year.
But that's undoubtedly interest from the thing. But yeah, they must be paying a rock low premium. And chances are this is what's known as a universal life insurance policy. And these are kind of flexible. And you can pick your premium with these things. And oftentimes, such policies end up grossly underfunded because people pick low premiums. And then after a number of years, the insurance company starts eating away at the cash value to cover its own fees. And before you know it, all you're left with is a piece of paper.
Do you know what your parents bought it for?
It says $3,000, so I'm not sure if that's how much they put in.
So they put in $3,000, and now it's the payout value would be $12,000?
$3,000? Wait a minute.
Like, I was looking, I have the original policy they gave me.
Yeah, they should have bought you shares of Ford.
Yeah,
or
I was thinking, I was wondering if they buy the IBM.
Okay, so what's your question for us? What, you want to know what to do with this?
Yeah, what do I do with this? I was thinking, should I cash it out and take the cash and I would put it in my IRA? Or should I just leave it as is and then, you know, when, you know, I pass away, my husband would get the death benefit, or we don't have children.
Rachel, what would you want the money to be used for? That's the first question. Would it be, for example, to cover your funeral costs when and if you shuffle off this mortal coil? Or would it be intended as some sort of nest egg for your husband?
Yeah, I would think if I, you know, kept it and he got the benefit, I would, for him to pay my, you know, our expenses and anything that he would need to cover. Or he could go on a nice trip.
Oh, you are generous, aren't you?
David, I think it's kind of hard for us without seeing the policy and trying to figure out exactly what she would get and what, I mean, there have got to be fees if she gets this payout and that sort of thing, but
I would say, and maybe I'm going out on a limb here, that I would say you don't need this policy. It's not really making any money for you. It doesn't seem to be that good a policy, and it's only going to be any good if you start jacking up the premiums and really putting some money into it. You can probably do that elsewhere with a better policy that you and your husband pick yourself, that you consolidate with your other insurance needs so you'll get the best possible rate. So maybe I'm overstepping, but my sense is you go for the surrender value, the cash value, which might be $3,000 or whatever it's going to be, and do something with it. I'm not saying go to Paris with it. I'm saying put it into an IRA, invest it in a CD, make it work for you under your terms.
So what do you think? What are you going to do?
I think even though my parents said don't ever touch this, because they're like, this is a good investment for you, I think I would cash it out and I'm going to invest it in my IRA.
Yeah.
But more importantly, which one was your favorite angel?
Oh, Sabrina.
The smart one.
Yeah.
That's why you listen to Marketplace.
And I'm sure that was your favorite too, David?
The smart one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's the poster I had on my dorm wall.
Right.
Yeah, you betcha.
All right, does that help you out, Rachel?
It does. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. If you've got a financial question, tell us about it. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can write to us. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. David, thanks, as always, for the grand advice.
Too fun, Tess.
Happy weekend.
You too.
Remember to check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles. For a free audiobook of your choice, including In the Plex by Stephen Levy or The New Frugality by Chris Farrell, go to audiblepodcast.com/marketplacemoney.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Lauren McMahon, and we are in Pasadena, California. Just like some cards and an old Sun and Sail Club card. I have a bowling members card. Yeah, I was on a bowling league for a while, and then I moved, and I stopped bowling, and I completely forgot that I even owned this. Well, my grandmother made me start bowling because she worked at the bowling alley. And she started her own league on Wednesday nights. And she said, Lauren, I need someone to bowl and I'll pay for you. And I said, cool. So I got to bowl for free every week. And then I stopped because I moved. I do miss bowling a lot. It was a lot of fun. And now my average has gone down so much. It used to be like in the 150s. And now it's like 110. And I miss it. But I have to pay for it now, so I don't want to go back.
Brown nosing gets a bad rap, but flattery might just get you everywhere.
It might sound like ingratiation, but in fact, what you're doing is you are letting people know, these are the skills and abilities that I value in you.
A new perspective on sucking up to the boss coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. Among the things you probably hate in life, all that time wasted on your commute. But the growing popularity of both smartphones and social media means software developers are jumping into the transportation app business, hopefully saving you some time and maybe even some money. From the Transportation Nation Public Radio Project at WNYC, Andrea Bernstein reports.
New Yorkers hate waiting for just about anything. For us, standing in a bus stop, excruciating.
Because when the bus doesn't come, it's the worst, which is partially why I don't take the bus, because it's too annoying. Because you wait and wait and wait.
I found Shira Katz riding the B67 bus in Brooklyn. She was dreaming of what she would do if she knew when the bus was coming before she even left her house.
I'd read my book. Yeah. Sleep. Work.
Enter Roadify, a software app that combines official schedules with user-generated information. Nick Nyan is the founder of Roadify. He works in market research, and one day, he was looking for a parking spot in New York City.
And I was frustrated because there I was waiting for a spot, sitting there double parked on a street with my phone in my hand. And I knew that people were leaving spots and they had phones in their hands. And there was no way for us to trade information that would be useful.
So he developed an app. But parking was just the beginning. Then came Roadify's popular feature, the ability for bus riders and subway riders to share information about when buses and trains are actually arriving, not just when they're scheduled to. A platform. This spring, Roadify won the grand prize in the recent Big Apple's Big Apps contest.
It's in the zeitgeist.
Brandon Kessler ran the competition. He says 40% of this year's winners were transportation-related.
So your transportation experience can be improved by technology that knows where you are through your GPS chip in your phone and can give you information that's relevant to your location.
But that doesn't mean it works for everyone. Bus riders tend to be older and poorer than the general population, and that means they don't have fancy phones. And down in the subways, programmer Anand Mohandas isn't sure about the quality of information.
It relies on people to know the status of stuff. Seems too unreliable.
But financial advisor Louis Siriaco has to travel around to meet with clients. With an app like this,
probably see a client and not be late to my meetings.
If your train were delayed, would you send that in?
I wouldn't want anybody else to be late to a client meeting, so by all means.
He says he'll go download it now, as soon as his train comes, and he can get to work. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace Money.
And for stories on getting around in cars, buses, and subways, check out our link to the Transportation Nation website at marketplace.org. Some insurance companies now have apps for auto coverage. Experts say it is best to compare quotes from at least four companies before making a decision. Amy Denise is senior managing editor at Insure.com, and she joins us with some more money-saving car insurance tips. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
How much does the type of car you drive have an effect on your rate?
It affects your rate a lot if you're buying collision and comprehensive coverage. But if you're only buying liability, then it doesn't affect you.
Can you expand on that?
Well, sure. So liability is the damage that you do to other people when you crash into them. So that's not based on your car model. But collision and comprehensive are for damage to your own vehicle, like say you hit a tree or you sideswipe a guardrail or hit a deer. So now your model is an important part of your price because then you're looking at how much it would cost to repair or replace your particular vehicle.
Why does my zip code make any difference at all?
And it makes a huge difference because the rates you pay are, to some extent, based on the other drivers in your community.
But that's not fair.
It's not fair at all. But
I have nothing to do with how my neighbor drives.
It does to insurance companies. So if there are a lot of people crashing frequently where you live, or even if they don't crash frequently, but they have very expensive claims because perhaps they're driving expensive cars, then that does affect your own premium.
But why?
Well, it's all about risk. So essentially, insurance companies will say that you live in a risky place and your own risk of a crash is higher because those around you are filing more claims.
Wow. Okay.
Yes.
I guess it's just one of those facts of life. Now, what about bundling your insurance so that you're with the same company for your car, your house, perhaps your apartment rental insurance? Will that generally get you a better rate?
It will. And that's a common way to get a discount. Also ask for safety discounts, anti-theft devices in your vehicle. If you're 55 or older, you can probably get a discount for taking a defensive driving class.
You know, my car insurance company, with whom I also have my home insurance, told me some time ago that I needed to boost my car insurance up quite a bit because I was a homeowner. I guess the theory being that if I were sued over an accident, I would want to make sure that they wouldn't be able to take my house. What's your advice on that?
I would agree with that. The more assets you have to protect, the higher liability limits you should be carrying, or else you're really opening yourself up to a lawsuit that's not covered by insurance.
I've seen this pay-as-you-drive insurance all over the place recently. Can you tell us what that is, and does it save you money?
So this is usage-based insurance, meaning that your insurance rate is based on exactly how much you drive. So in order to do this, the insurance company sends you a device that plugs into your car, and it records how many miles you're driving, if you're braking suddenly, and the time of day you drive, because even nighttime driving is riskier. And then all this goes into creating your own personalized car insurance rate.
So it's basically like having mom in the back seat.
It is a little bit, yes.
Well, can you share perhaps the top three most expensive cars to insure and maybe the least expensive cars?
Sure. So for 2011 models, the least expensive vehicles to insure are the Chrysler Town & Country, the Toyota Sienna, and the Honda Odyssey. And the most expensive at the other end of the spectrum are the Mercedes SL65 convertible, the BMW 750 hybrids, and the Mercedes SL63 convertible.
All right. Amy Denise is a senior managing editor at Insure.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we are talking about cars all week at marketplace.org/money as part of our preparation to go on the road for an entire show about you, your cars, and all the money you spend on them. Contrary to popular belief, brown nosing is not a dirty word. Turns out it's an art. And your ability to flatter could be what's standing between you and success. But, of course, overt sucking up won't work. If you're too obvious, it can backfire. Sally Herships tells us how to master the technique.
We've all had tough gigs at work, but John Clendenin may have had one of the worst. About 25 years ago, he was working for Xerox. The company was downsizing, but Clendenin got a promotion, overseeing international logistics. There were just a couple of problems.
So we had no money, we had no people.
Then there was his new job, trying to save money for the corporation worldwide. Clendenin says regional managers were focused on their own bottom lines, not the corporation. And there's more. If Clendenin wanted to add to his budget, he had to get the local managers to save on theirs. That's where his funding would come from. But he had to persuade them to make changes, because Clendenin had no authority.
So in the very beginning, I was the person going around asking for money when everybody was having their budget cut.
But Clendenin got results. He saved Xerox $700 million. So how did he do it? In the boardroom, it's called sophisticated interpersonal influence, or ingratiation. You can also call it sucking up. We already know it can boost your career. You're more likely to ascend to the corporate elite if you're an expert at flattery.
Tactics like flattering you, rendering favors, conforming my opinion to your opinion.
Ithai Stern is a professor of organizational theory and strategy at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. He co-authored a new study on how to ingratiate right. He says one of the keys is being subtle.
Things like framing flattery as advice-seeking.
Picture for a moment the traditional American workplace. Here's how flattery fits in.
Steve, I'm working on this tough new project for corporate. I was wondering how you were able to pull together the team so successfully.
Well, Collins, let me tell you. It took a lot of late nights, but we got that new strategy implemented.
Asking for help instead of pouring on the praise is less likely to be interpreted as flattery.
Other things would be arguing prior to conforming.
It may seem counterintuitive, but arguing first seems more genuine.
No, John, I just don't think your calculations add up.
After you put on a tough front, then you can let someone think they've actually managed to convince you.
I guess I just didn't see it that way before. Put me down as a yes.
You can also pass along compliments through a third party. But with all of these strategies, you have to be careful.
If you do it in a very aggressive way, in a way that would be very obvious, that all you're trying to do is gain favor, it's actually going to backfire.
And your chance of climbing the corporate ladder goes down. But some people tend to be really good ingratiators. Lawyers, politicians, and marketers. I asked Batya Wiesenfeld why. She teaches management at Stern School of Business.
Classes in social networks and leadership have been part of business schools for absolutely decades.
Wiesenfeld says students are taught how to analyze social situations the same way they would a balance sheet.
It might sound like ingratiation, but in fact, what you're doing is you are letting people know, these are the skills and abilities that I value in you.
And by doing so, you empower them to use those abilities more. So business students study great flatterers, like John Clendenin and what he did at Xerox. I asked him if he had any tips.
A lot of the people in business, once they become the boss, they expect that everybody is going to ingratiate them.
Instead, Clendenin says, get on your employees' wavelength. They're the people you should be ingratiating, the ones who get the job done for you. Oh, and hey, I love doing stories for smart listeners like you. So an extra big thanks for listening. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
Managing your money is no simple feat, but for some folks, it's as easy as doodling on the back of a napkin. Some being Carl Richards. He's the founder of Prasada Capital Management in Park City, Utah. And you see his Sharpie drawings in the New York Times Bucks column. We talk with him every so often, and he's back with another rendering. Welcome again.
Thank you, Tess. Good to be here.
Describe for us what's on this napkin.
So this is part of the Conversations Around Money series. And if you notice, it's sort of this circular conversation that says, she says, and then the next line over says, I hear, and it's got a dollar sign. And then it says, again, she says, and the next line over says, I hear, and a dollar sign.
And there are arrows pointing all the way around this circular logic
here.
What are you talking about here?
This is one that was specifically sparked by a conversation I had with my wife.
So we get a peek into your marriage now.
Yeah, she loves this. She's just so excited about this. The story is she would often come home and say something like, hey, I was just over at Kim's house and she remodeled her kitchen. I immediately, and I've had lots of conversations with people about this, so I know I'm not alone. It made me feel better. I would immediately be calculating that cost X. And she is saying, hey, you know, it was really nice, and I'm calculating, and I may even say, Corey, we can't afford that.
And she's like, I wasn't asking you for a new kitchen.
Right. What are you talking about? And the same thing happened, I think, that day. She came home from a ride in somebody's car, and it was comfortable or whatever, and she said, oh, it was so nice, and I said, you know, we can't afford it. And she's like, I don't even know what you're talking about. I was just talking about the car. Like, I had a good ride. So it made me realize, you know, how different we view money.
Why do you think you automatically assume that she was saying that she wanted what she was talking about?
I do not know. I think it's because that's maybe how I view money. Like, I've never enjoyed going to look at open houses because I assume, hey, if we're going to buy a house, we'd go look at open houses.
Mm-hmm.
However, my wife, and there are plenty of people just like her, both male and female, that enjoy going to open houses just for the experience. So it's just the viewpoint I bring to those conversations was drastically different than the one she brings.
Have you changed your behavior since you had this realization?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this was only, what was this, I think a month or two ago that I drew this one. And for sure, I now pause and say, okay, wait a second, wait. And in fact, this is maybe the point of this whole series, is instead of just talking around this issue, I'm trying to stop and say, now wait. Before we go on, are we talking about something we want to do or are we talking about just some fun experience? And I think what you do is you have to, at least for me, you've got to recognize it's sort of like any other problem. We've got to first recognize that we have the problem. So I think it's just recognizing, stop talking around money and start talking about it.
Carl Richards napkins are found on our website. It's marketplace.org. And we're talking to him over these next several weeks about behavioral finance based on his drawings. Carl, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tess.
And by the way, you can find him on Twitter at Behavior Gap. While you're at it, follow me at Radio Tess. And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Atlanta, Georgia, and listener V.S. She wrote to us this week to vent about her account at Bank of America. She gets paid 9 months out of the year, and she keeps thousands of dollars sitting in her checking account. But the bank imposed fees for the 3 months she didn't have direct deposits. So she moved her money to a different B of A account. And then on a trip abroad, she accidentally withdrew from her savings instead of checking, ka-ching, overdraft fees. So she closed the savings account and another emergency account, and then she was charged for transferring those balances. I'm a business professor, she tells us, and I am so ashamed of myself for being cheated that I don't want to use my name. Well, don't be ashamed. Our pig is coming to your rescue, and it's not nearly as deep in the slop as your bank is. All right, don't forget, one of our coveted blue friends will be awarded to the person who becomes Facebook Fan X. We have not hit that magic number just yet. Could be you, so head on over and like us. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, start your engines.
I've got a 4 or 5 year old Porsche 911.
Both my wife and I have minivans.
I drive my Excursion diesel.
A 2012 Ford Mustang RTR.
I've got 232 Fords.
I have an old Jag. And when I say old, I just mean like a 99 XKR.
We are hitting the road for a special remote broadcast about us and our cars. You will not believe how far we're going to bring you this story. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins, Stephen Hoffman, and Sonata Lee Narsis. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
The
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. This is APM, American Public Media.